Thank you. May it please the court, Robert Borquez, registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Marcos Garcia Flores, who appeals the denial of his Rule 35C motion for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. And Mr. Garcia Flores was convicted of first-degree assault and sexual assault back in 2002. His direct appeal was became final in August of 2005, and within 2 months, October of 2005, he filed his first of several motions for post-conviction relief in this matter. So it was within about 60 days of when the mandate issued. Unfortunately, the Pitkin District Court did not address any of his pro se motions or his requests for counsel for almost 6 years. I believe it was December 2011 when counsel was first appointed for him. Because the panel has read the briefs, I'm going to skip over most of the facts in this case and get right to the two legal issues I want to try to cover this afternoon. But the first issue has to do with the handling of my client's request for appointment of substitute counsel. And at the trial in this case began in, I think it was the third week in April 2002, and about 3 weeks before then, April 1st, 2002, there was a pretrial conference. And at that conference, my client indicated his dissatisfaction with appointed counsel. And what happened next at that pretrial conference is very significant to the issue we're here on today. And what happened was, basically, when my client voiced his dissatisfaction, the judge who was scheduled to hear the case for trial in 3 weeks heard the complaint about counsel. The matter was not referred to a different division or a different courtroom for a conflict hearing. The judge did not apparently tell my client that anything said at this hearing would be ex parte, that it could not be used at trial. Didn't tell him to be candid about what his complaints were. And it appears that the prosecutor, the trial prosecutor, remained in the courtroom during this this exchange. These are the steps that customarily are taken when a defendant expresses dissatisfaction with appointed counsel. Frequently, the matter is referred to a coordinate-level judge who conducts a conflict hearing. And the people in their answer brief cite the Kruger case, which is actually an excellent illustration of how such a conflict claim should have been handled. In Kruger, the defendant was an individual who was extremely articulate and basically drafted a number of motions seeking appointment of substitution counsel, went into great detail in his motions, and the trial judge in that case sent the matter to several different division judges for, I think there were a total of three different conflict hearings. There was an ample record made in that case as far as allowing for review on direct appeal.
Well, Mr. Borquez, sorry, let me ask you about the record here in this case. So when the court did ask, you know, what is your dissatisfaction with counsel, then defendant did explain it was for counsel's lack of investigation?
That's correct, Your Honor, but it was a very, very cursory, I guess would be the word, very limited amount of disclosure as to what. He didn't go into any details other than his complaint was that there was a lack of investigation.
Well, he said two things. He said, he's not investigating my case and he keeps telling me I'm gonna spend my life in prison.
Right. Yes, Your Honor, and those are two different issues, and we don't dispute. I mean, trial counsel's advice about the potential sentence was accurate, all right? And obviously that upset my client. But we're not here claiming that that was an issue because it was accurate advice. If he was acquitted, he'd be free to go home to Mexico. If he was convicted, I think he was looking at a minimum of 26 years to life. So, but there was also the issue of adequacy of the investigation. And I think that he brought up enough there that that should have triggered a conflict hearing and sent the matter to another courtroom.
But I guess I'm not understanding. The court then turned to his lawyer and said, what's your response? And I recognize maybe you should have sent him someplace else, maybe send the prosecutor out, which you really haven't argued in your briefs here. I mean, it's the first time I've heard the concern about, you know, the prosecutor was in the room right now. I don't think that's in your brief. But, you know, that aside, he turned to the defense lawyer and So defense lawyer said, well, you are investigating. He mentioned who his investigator was and what they're doing. And the response to the question, what's the problem, included the issue about my sentence. And the lawyer explained, I advised him what he was looking at. And the court concluded there was no conflict. I mean, that happens kind of all the time. We see, you can find hundreds of cases of ours that deal with that issue. And I guess I'm not clear what the problem is. Why would we have needed more of a record? The court asked him, you know, Mr. Garcia Flores, what's the problem? And he told them what the problem was.
Well, basically, Your Honor, you have in this case a defendant who has an issue with his lawyer. For, I think we'd all agree there was some kind of a dispute. Basically, he was in that courtroom all alone, and he should have been advised that this is your opportunity to go to explain to me in detail what the problem is. What do you think your lawyer should be doing that he's not doing? That question wasn't put to him, and he didn't have anybody else in that courtroom advocating for him, because basically, once he's saying my lawyer isn't doing a very good job, he and his lawyer have something of a conflict there, at least to the extent of the proceeding that they were in there on.
Well, didn't he? I'm just repeating what Judge Gabriel just said, but didn't the defendant say my lawyer's not investigating? That why would the court have to ask him, what more is your lawyer not doing?
Because I think under the Bergerud decision, Your Honor, where there's a question like this, as far as where there's a claim that there's a conflict between counsel and the attorney, I think that it's incumbent upon the court to develop an adequate record. And I think under Bergerud, it says that you're supposed to hear from both the attorney and the defendant. And in this case, we have an immigrant who has limited command of the English language in there with limited education background. And he's basically being held to a standard that a lawyer should be handled or held to, which is, you know, tell me in detail what the problem is. And you're putting the burden on him there. The only thing the trial judge should have done, or the conflict division judge should have done, was ask, I need more detail than that, or I'm not going to be able to entertain your request.
Well, it is my recollection of that conversation that the trial court didn't say, I need more detail, but the transcript seems to indicate that the trial court said, more? Is there more? There was a question, more? And the defendant said, no.
I don't remember exactly what the transcript says, and I'll certainly defer to what's actually in the transcript and if it says that. But I think that it still needs to be made clear that he's got to come up with, he's got to have better reasons than this. And I think there was enough there that there was a red flag that went up.
I'm sorry, if you say he needs to have better reasons, are you referring to the defendant needs?
He should have been told that here is your opportunity if you have any more reason.
Okay, so if the transcript did indeed show that the court asked him, is there anything more, and even if he did respond to something there being more, your position is he should have been told you need to, not just more, but you need to explain in more detail.
Correct.
What you're talking about. Okay, so I understand.
That's where I'm going with that. And I think given his limited background that he should have been given the opportunity to go into more detail on that.
All right. Could you respond to it? Because I know you're aware from the answer brief that Ms. Hansen has said that actually this case is procedurally barred, or this issue is, because...
Because it was raised on direct appeal?
Or should have been raised on
Should have been raised on... Yeah, yeah, and the reason it's not procedurally barred, Your Honor, is that there was a woefully inadequate record based upon what took place at the conflict hearing. In both the Apodaca case, which the people also cite, and the Kruger case, those cases had very detailed records made. So it was an issue that was ripe for review on direct appeal. What happened in Apodaca, I believe the defendant filed a pro se motion spelling out why he wanted a new lawyer. The lawyer filed a motion to withdraw his counsel spelling out what the issue was, and there was actually some kind of document that was made a sealed part of the record. So there was an adequate record for review. Here we have basically, I think it was 66 lines of text at the pretrial conference on April 1st.
But where, and Mr. Borquez, is there a rule about how many lines? And again, you've been at this a long time, and I have respect for what you do. But we see a lot of cases by way of example. I got a problem with my attorney. I want a new attorney. What's the problem? He hasn't visited me in prison. He doesn't call me enough. That would be about 10 words. You'll find hundreds of cases probably from our court addressing that. I mean, I don't know what more record there would be. And it seems to me like you said there needs to be more detail on them. I guess I'm not following why. If the court said with no limitation, Mr. Garcia Flores, what is the conflict? And he tells them what the conflict is. It may be four words, and the court could say, I don't think that's good enough. So where's the line you're asking us to draw, I guess, is the question.
That's a good illustration, Your Honor, because this is different than the client, the litigant. And I know the cases you're talking about, where the defendant says, my lawyer doesn't visit me enough or take all of my phone calls or spend enough time with me. That's another big one. But that's different than this. Here you're talking about the quality of the representation, not the frequency of visits and that kind of stuff. And I think when he mentioned isn't investigating enough, I think that should have been a trigger right there as far as requiring some kind of further exploration of the issue.
Okay.
I have about 3 minutes and 55 seconds left. I just want to very briefly talk about the other issue because there's a couple of procedural glitches that arise in that issue. I just want to address and then maybe save a minute for rebuttal. But regarding the issue of the ineffective litigation of the translation of the statements. And the people brought up in their answer brief the procedural glitches that we are dealing with there. One of which was that in the supplemental motion that appointed counsel filed in December, or actually not until 2012, I guess she filed it, because she was appointed in December of 2011, she did not allege Jen's justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. And obviously, that motion is not a model of drafting, and it should have been pleaded. But there's adequate facts in this case to support a Jens claim. We have the mandate came down in August of 2005. The first post-trial or pro se post-conviction relief motion is filed in October of 2005. There are a number of subsequent requests for appointment of counsel. There are a number of supplemental motions filed pro se. And finally, 6 years later, the district court finally appoints counsel and made the determination that my client was eligible for appointment of counsel. Had counsel been appointed in 2005 or 2006, the translation issue could and would have been pleaded in a timely manner. So,
I know you want to save time here, Mr. Borges.
Sure.
Let me just ask you one question on this. Is there anything in the record where your client complained about a specific translation that was wrong or inadequate? I have to say, I didn't see it.
I didn't see one either, Your Honor, so I think you're correct there.
Thank you.
Any other questions right now? All right, with that, I'll save my minute and 58 seconds for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. There's two issues raised in this post-conviction appeal. Obviously, the dissatisfaction of counsel and the court's failure to properly inquire, and ineffective assistance of counsel for not properly litigating the suppression motion. This court need not get to the merits of either of his claim, and in fact, should not get to the merits of either of these claims because both claims are procedurally barred. The first claim regarding dissatisfaction of counsel and the court's failure to properly inquire is barred under Rule 35C37, which requires the defendant to raise claims that could have been raised in the direct appeal, and he cannot raise those claims then for the first time on post-conviction relief.
Ms. Hansen, I know your opposing counsel has stated that the record was not sufficient to be able to raise that type of issue on direct appeal. Can you respond to that?
Well, I have not seen any case that indicates that that's an exception to that requirement. In Kelling, they specifically acknowledge that this is not an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. This is a claim regarding whether the trial court properly conducted an inquiry into the defendant's dissatisfaction with counsel. Basically, that inquiry is the trial court's ruling, the colloquy that occurred at that time. And so, to the extent that any additional record needed to be made, it needed to be made by the defendant at that time. And so if he's claiming that the trial court should have inquired further, the record is complete as to that claim.
Okay, thank you.
And I think repeated cases, Kelling, Davis, Bergerud, all recognize that these are the type of claims that are and should be raised on direct appeal. With regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that claim is procedural barred for two reasons. One is that it's clearly untimely. The defendant doesn't dispute that it's untimely. He just argues for the first time in his reply brief that there's justifiable excuse based on the failure of the court to appoint counsel until 7 years later. However, this court has repeatedly recognized that the lack of counsel or legal advice is not grounds for justifiable excuse. This is not a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, which would might, in some circumstances, establish justifiable excuse. It's just the lack of counsel, and that's, as a matter of law, not sufficient. Even if this court were inclined to address justifiable excuse for the first time at this point.
Ms. Hansen, please correct me if I have this wrong. Didn't the trial judge say it was timely on this one? And I may have my issues mixed up, but I thought the trial court made a finding that it was timely. And I suspect the trial judge was probably feeling a little sheepish by, it sounded like a mess in the trial court, you know, with all due respect to my friends at the trial bench, to have it 6 years and where's this case gone? But I thought that the trial judge made a specific finding that this was timely. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't recall, and I think that would be something I would have noted. If I'm wrong, certainly the statute allows this court to address timeliness for the first time on appeal. And so the defendant admittedly didn't raise any grounds for justifiable excuse below, which would have had to have been done in the motion, not in response to the court's order. I certainly think that this court can and should address that for the first time here, although I don't recall the court specifically finding it was timely.
And if I have it wrong, I read a lot of cases, and I may just be mixing up cases. If I got it wrong, I apologize to you. Well, let me ask you, I understand the bar question. Assuming we can get past that and we have to look at justifiable excuse, we get to that. Why wouldn't this be justifiable excuse and excusable neglect for the reasons that Mr. Borquez says? I mean, this sounds like no fault of counsel. The court kind of messed up, just got lost. And there's repeated motions. And finally, it seemed to me like the trial judge at the end said, you know what, we're going to appoint counsel here and get this record square and have one motion, and we're going to address all the issues, which seems to be what she did. I mean, her finding seemed to be when she appointed counsel, I think there's enough here. Let's have a do-over and give me the issues. Why wouldn't it at least relate back to the first one? Because he did file the first one within a month.
Correct. Well, I mean, I think it definitely doesn't relate back because it has nothing to do with the claims that were raised in the first motion or the second motion or the third motion. So he raised numerous motions, didn't raise this particularly ineffective assistance counsel claim.
Sure, but the court ultimately, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, I will hear you out, I promise. But the court ultimately did say, I think this man needs counsel. There's still a lot of mess here. And then counsel finally gets appointed. I mean, counsel should, on that theory, and what I was saying about relation back really was trying to say, counsel probably should have been appointed at the front end, within, you know, when he first filed, and not 6 years down the road. Well, I guess I'm concerned that we're punishing Mr. Garcia Flores for the court's errors.
Well, it's not the court's fault that he chose to raise this, he chose not to raise the claim in any of his post-conviction motions. So it was the defendant's decision in his pro se motions not to raise this claim. I certainly don't think that the court's ruling ultimately appointing counsel was necessarily acknowledging that it should have been appointed all along. In fact, I would argue that counsel never should have been appointed at all. And so, but the bottom line is the argument for justifiable excuse is that he didn't have access to counsel until 2012. So if that's his argument, that as a matter of law doesn't constitute justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. This is definitely not a situation where counsel was appointed and then failed to raise the claim, failed to acknowledge the claim and raise it in a timely manner and maybe filed an untimely supplemental motion. So this is not post-conviction counsel's doing. This is not the court's doing. This is the defendant's not raising this claim in three motions that he filed, and in this situation, so there's no justifiable excuse based on ineffective assistance of counsel, and as a matter of law, there's no justifiable excuse based on the lack of counsel, so whether the court should have appointed counsel earlier just doesn't affect that question.
Thank you.
As I argued, also the second claim is procedurally barred as well because it is basically based on the same issues that the Court of Appeals addressed in the direct appeal. So for that reason as well, it should be barred. I don't have anything additional unless this court would have any questions about the merits of the claims, but it's our position that you shouldn't get to the merits of the claims, that they're procedurally barred.
Okay. Understanding your position on the procedural bar, can you go ahead and address your position on the merits?
Well, as I indicated in the brief, I think the trial court's inquiry as to the defendant's dissatisfaction with counsel was more than adequate. The court asked, it was raised by defense counsel. The court asked the defendant, what would you like to say? The defendant made some vague general assertions. The court asked more, which clearly was interpreted by the defendant as, do you have anything more? Because the defendant responded and basically said, well, I just kind of assumed that he would do more for me and not tell me I'm going to go to jail if I get convicted. The court then inquired of defense counsel. Defense counsel explained that they were investigating, they were preparing for case, they were interviewing four witnesses at that point. And the court determined that based on the defendant's allegations, there wasn't sufficient evidence to support substitution of counsel. I'd also like to point out, so I think that the inquiry was fine, the reasons for the dissatisfaction didn't warrant substitute counsel, but even if we're looking at this under the law as set forth in Kelling, even if there was a failure to adequately advise, reversal is not warranted where, not adequately advise, adequately inquire. Reversal is not required where not only has the defendant been given the opportunity to give his statements, the statements made don't warrant substitution of counsel, but he hasn't further identified at any later point any indication of what he would say if there was a further inquiry. And he has completely failed to do that here. And so I think what the court did was fine, but even if it was not enough, the case law says he's still got to identify what further inquiry would have revealed. And he hasn't alleged anything along that lines.
All right.
Ask you one more procedural question. I'm glad I'm not totally nuts. The court did make a finding that this was timely. It's at paragraph 18. And it's even heading A, defendant's Rule 35C motion was timely filed. It just says, because defendant brought this collateral attack on his conviction within 3 years of the issuance of the mandate from the Court of Appeals, this motion is timely. I recognize you disagree with that. I guess my question is, number one, can we even, do we address timeliness on our own? There's no cross appeal or anything. Is it an alternative ground for conviction where we have, or an alternative ground for affirmance where we have discretion, or what? I mean, I'm just kind of curious whether we get to these issues when the court itself found it timely.
Well, I think if you look at the court was clearly dealing with all the post-conviction motions. So Right. Clearly the first couple were timely. And then the argument is whether the fourth motion raising the ineffective assistance claim was that claim itself was timely because it wasn't included until 7 years later.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see Ms. Hansen. It's addressed all of the 30. She's got it broken out, the 35C issues and the 35B issues. Her conclusion was all of them. I mean, she doesn't distinguish. It's headed at the top of that whole section.
Well, then,
assuming that's right, my question is, I mean, I think your argument would be we could get there as an alternative ground and not, you know, just say it was untimely, but do we or what?
Well, certainly you have the discretion to find that it's untimely. And I think in the context of this, I think it's pretty clear that the trial court, perhaps being sheepishly acting because so many motions had gone so long, was giving the defendant the benefit of the doubt as to appointing counsel. And in this case, finding that the motion was timely. Again, I'm not sure how it could find that the 2012 motion was timely. So I think that would be a clearly erroneous finding. That motion was clearly not timely. The defendant agrees that it was not timely. The question is whether the claims raised in that motion relate back to the timely filed motion to allow their consideration, or did the defendant allege justifiable excuse or excusable neglect? And so I think, you know, to the extent that the court was being generous to the defendant, we disagree. We disagree that that motion was timely. This court certainly, under the statute, has a discretion to address the timeliness of the motion. and the grounds, the only grounds alleged for justifiable excuse fail as a matter of law.
Thank you.
Unless there's any further questions, I'd ask that this court affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Borquez, you have just under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief here. I did catch where Judge Gabriel found that in the record, and that's actually why we didn't go into it in the opening brief, is I was treating that as the law of the case. I understand under 16-5402 that doesn't preclude this court from exercising its discretion on that issue. However, given the facts in this case, just because you can exercise that discretion doesn't mean that you should. And my client did make his repeated requests. Some of them were within the time, within the three-year time bar, and it wasn't until 6 years later that counsel was appointed. The other thing I just wanted to touch on was a question that Judge Gabriel asked during my opening argument, and that was where in our brief we addressed the what happened at the what I call the conflict hearing, where my client voiced his issues with his lawyer. And page 3 of our reply brief, the second and third paragraphs, I go into what was discussed at the pretrial conference. Unless there are any other questions, we would just ask that, given the procedural history of this case and the fact that my client's motion was denied without a hearing, that the panel reverse the order denying the 35C motion, remand it for 35C hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both of you for your excellent arguments. They'll be very helpful to us in arriving at a decision on this case. The matter will now stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course.